Hello and welcome back to Heights Libraries Podcast, Unpacking 1619, where you can explore the interviews we've collected with scholars from around the country, in which we unpack topics relating to race in America. I'm your host, John Pichet, and I'm thrilled to share these interviews with you here. John Kyle Day, assistant professor in the Department of History at Michigan State University, talks about his book, The Southern Manifesto, Massive Resistance and the Fight to Preserve Segregation. Here we are from June 13th, 2022.
My name is Kyle Day, and I am a professor of history at the University of Arkansas at Monticello.
Excellent. And today we're going to be talking about your book, The Southern Manifesto, Massive Resistance and the Fight to Preserve Segregation, which came out in 2014, correct?
Yes.
So what were you hoping to accomplish with the book, and why did the Southern Manifesto interest you?
I've been interested in American political history, Southern political history, and particularly Arkansas political history since I was a young person. Grew up in Fayetteville, Arkansas, attended Fayetteville Public Schools, went to the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville before I went on to do my grad work at the University of Missouri at Columbia under Robert Collins. But I guess you just grow up in it and you're immersed in it when you come from Arkansas. As I mentioned in my book, Fayetteville Public Schools was one of the first public schools in the South to abide by the decision of Brown v. Board of Education, 1954. And very much interested in political history. I guess growing up in the 1970s and 80s, we had and historically we've always taken a lot of pride in our congressional delegation from Arkansas, going all the way back, say, to Joe T. Robinson, the 1930s, the famous wheel horse of the New Deal. But the 1980s, we had Senators David Pryor and Dale Bumpers as our two U.S. senators. And we also, of course, had Governor and future President Bill Clinton as our governor. We had a very good House delegation, too, some very talented Republicans there as well. And so, regardless of your own personal politics, I think you have to admit that's some really good political talent. And then, of course, growing up in Fayetteville as well, we have growing up a very much a strong identification, almost iconic identification with Senator J. William Fulbright. He was a native son of Fayetteville, University of Arkansas, Rhodes Scholar, of course, very famous for his committing the United States to participation in the United Nations during World War II, and that is his student foreign exchange program. Internationally known, probably the most famous Arkansasian before Bill Clinton, and of course a liberal icon today, probably still today the intellectual progenitor of the Democratic Party. But I was always in the 1990s in particular studying at the University of Arkansas, some really good scholarship going on around on Fulbright, of course the really excellent biography by Randall Woods and so forth, that it seemed to be almost a cult of personality regarding Fulbright, where people obscured his firm commitment to segregation and opposition to the civil rights movement, the Black freedom struggle, the 1950s and 60s. And so that was an issue that I've always was interested in. My master's thesis was, of course, on Brooks Hayes, another liberal icon, largely forgotten today, but I think it certainly is many ways as influential as Fulbright, first layman to serve as president of the Southern Baptist Convention and so forth, and infamously lost his congressional seat in the wake of the 1957 Central High Crisis. And he too, both a strong integrationist when it came to the Southern Baptist Convention. He at one time served as a missionary to South Africa, opposed fundamental civil rights legislation in Congress. And so that was always a question for me. So when I approached the Southern Manifesto, I had an excellent mentor in Robert Collins, the University of Missouri, and previously at the University of Arkansas under James Chase, they asked me to treat the Southern Manifesto as a political document and maybe look at other seminal works of history that have done this, say Gary Wills's exit book on the Gettysburg Address or John Hope Franklin's a great book on the Emancipation Proclamation that was published in 1963. And so that was kind of my framework when how I approached the Southern Manifesto.
That's interesting. Now, can you explain to us what the Declaration of Constitutional Principles, aka the Southern Manifesto, was and how it came about?
Yeah, sure. It was formally proclaimed on March 13th, 1956. I treat it as a legal proffer, a statement of principles by the Southern Congressional Delegation in general, but the Senate Southern Caucus in particular, formally stating that they not only disagreed with the constitutionality of the Brown decision, but would also thereafter oppose any and all civil rights legislation that came before the Congress. In particular, they were focused on what becomes the 1957 Civil Rights Act, and which is, of course, tabled by Senate Majority Leader Johnson after conferring with a lot of national Democrats for the 1956 election. It could have passed. I argue it could have passed in 56, but it would have led to fundamental realignment. Passes in 1957. What becomes known as the Southern Manifesto is essentially a line in the sand. It's signed by 99 Southern congressmen and senators, which ensures that the South is united against federal desegregation efforts in the 1950s and 60s.
And I'm interested into kind of what it said, because there are two kind of arguments in your book. One is that it's a test case on how the Southern delegation preserves white supremacy, but then it also becomes this document of moderate consensus. And that is an interesting kind of parallel narrative you have going.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. It is a somewhat tightrope that I walk and that I think the Southern Congressional Delegation walks. And if you can see this particularly with through the lens of nationally prominent Democrat like Brooks Hayes and like J. William Fulbright. One of the things I found so fundamental to this issue is something I think we neglect in our classes and we neglect in the historiography is the popularity of Dwight Eisenhower, particularly in the South in both 1952 and 56. We need to remember that Eisenhower won the three largest states in the South, the former states of the Confederacy, Texas, Virginia, and Florida in 52 and 56. And there's the Democratic Party, I guess the national political system, is fundamentally undergoing realignment in the 1950s, or as pressure to do so. And so I try to look through the lens of the Southern Congressional Delegation, and they were very much concerned that the assumption was that Brown is declared 1954, and the idea is public school districts throughout the South are going to have about approximately 1 year to adjust and comply with the issue. And so 1956, the fall 1956 school term would coincide with the national elections of 1956. And they were concerned if there was widespread desegregation, certainly all of them would get primaried, as well as there would be strong Republican candidates in the South. And there'd be a fundamental turnover in the Southern Congressional Delegation in the 1956 elections. And we have to remember in the one party South, the power of the South is in committee memberships. When there's a Democratic majority in Congress, those longstanding committee memberships are all powerful And that's one of the reasons the Eisenhower administration has to do business with them to get anything passed. And so that was one of the fundamental justifications for that. But of course, as I mentioned in the book, the intellectual stalwart behind this is, of course, Senator Richard Russell of Georgia, who, you know, some wags have said he was the South's greatest general since Robert E. Lee. That he was able to really consolidate opposition to desegregation under his leadership through this. And of course, I argue that delays all the fundamental legislation going up through 1964 and 65, Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act of 65, as well as the Civil Rights Act of 1968. Under his leadership, that would be in opposition to that, and that's what I consider it's one of the great ironies of modern political history is that through Russell's leadership, the Democratic Party, the South stays within the Democratic Party largely up until, of course, that generational turnover in the 1980s. So that's what I mean largely by a moderate consensus. I fundamentally question the idea that the Democratic Party is the political vehicle of the civil rights struggle. I think that bears, you know, larger issues about, you know, the idea that African Americans are largely on their own during the civil rights movement, and so forth, and the political process is fundamentally. And vigorously somewhat stultified to civil rights advances. So.
Yeah, and this document really seems to set the stage for kind of that move that you're saying, the kind of calcification of this anti-civil rights within the Democratic Party. And yes. I was interested to find out what the Southern Manifesto actually said. And some of the arguments are still with us today, I found to be interesting.
Yes, I don't want to read too much into the present day. I did spend a lot of time in the book focusing upon the struggle over the language that Southern Manifesto said, because there was a lot of intransigent segregations, I describe them, really radicals who wanted to declare the Brown decision as a legal usurpation of constitutional authority and outside the bounds of jurisprudence and so forth. Cooler heads prevailed and understood that all that would do was force the South out of the Democratic Party. That's one of the reasons I call it a moderate consensus, is that able to somewhat keep the language in a legal disagreement and so forth, essentially allowed national Democrats like Fulbright and Hayes to reason with some of the more intransigent colleagues, George Mathis of Florida and others, to understand that unity was the best way through opposition. Yeah. You know, when people we see today, I guess if we see today, you know, people threatening Supreme Court justices and politicians grandstanding and threatening the integrity of the Supreme Court, that's certainly legacy is troubling. I know we've had that in our republic before, but that's very troubling. I think we could look back to the 1950s and see that does nobody any good.
Yeah, and it's, I guess the, one of the statistics that jumped out at me, I guess to just kind of put this all in perspective is, you said on page 65, I guess it's Confederate states, only 16% of whites approved of Brown, while 80% disapproved. And in the South, outside the South, it was 71 for approval and 24 disapproved. And I guess that's the state that we're, that's the, not the state, the, condition of the population that we're talking about, but you know, because we think of desegregation now as just kind of happening and then we move on, right? But this is quite a roadblock to that, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, that's a very quite interesting statistic that I maybe still not know what to do with. A wise man once told me, you know, the media does not determine how we think, but they do determine what we think about, you know, creating saliency. And I think in Mary's respects, my book shows that a lot of the Southern delegation was somewhat fomenting public opinion in this regard. Certainly we later see in the 70s and 80s with public housing and school busing and so forth, and you know, the North was as opposed to desegregation as much as possible. A lot of people today are saying that both, I think, academics and a lot of leading political thinkers are saying that education is the modern civil rights issue of the modern day. I tend to agree with that, but I think it's a 70, 80. It's not a new issue. Certainly, going back to Brown and access to good public schools.
And yeah, and one of the threats that was made was that if you're going to make us do this, we will just do away with public schooling, and there'll be no. And it was Alabama. And Mississippi came out with similar statements.
Yeah, certainly that was a very much a strategy of the Mississippi Citizens Councils, who spread throughout those Christian academies that spring up in the 1960s and 70s for sure. I just don't know enough of today about the issue pertaining to charter schools and school choice today. I don't know if that's a legacy of that today or not, but certainly access to quality public schools, that tends to be a, you know, a longstanding issue.
And the real underlying, because I wanted to get back to citizens councils in a minute, but one of the real underlying tenets of wanting to maintain segregation was kind of this, it's a three-pronged, I think, attack of, like, it's always about interracial sex, right?
Yes.
So it's always about that at the core, but then there's also the, like, communist plot to do away with life in the South, right? And then you have the unconstitutionality of desegregation and this Supreme Court that was corrupted by personal politics, I guess, right? Mm-hmm. That's kind of the underlying justification for the Southern Manifesto.
A lot of scholars and historians have really pointed to the issue of interracial sex. Betsy Jacoby's extensive book, Turn Away Thy Son, on the Little Rock Central High School. That's one of the underlying premises of her book. You know, the issue about interracial dating and so forth, and in high schools and so forth, was the blatant negrophobia on the part of Southern whites very much was a first and foremost in those issues, and really. Mountbank politicians like James Eastland of Mississippi could very much exploit that, prey upon people's fears, for sure. The second point you make, could you repeat that, please?
The other three prong were, you know, kind of this the communist plot to destroy American society, specifically mm-hmm. the South. Desegregation was unconstitutional, mm-hmm. and then you had this political court, basically, that was.
Sure. Yeah, the anti-communism was used by Southern politicians, you know, coming out of McCarthyism and so forth. They tried to make some connection between the civil rights struggle and Soviet domination. People like Strom Thurmond or Dale Alford, who defeated Brooks Hayes in Little Rock. That was so intellectual vacuous. We do know, you know, that if you look at David Chappelle's excellent work, A Stone of Hope, one of the great books ever written on the civil rights struggle. The Black freedom struggle comes out of the African American church, and these are Southern evangelicals who have nothing to do with communism, you know, whatsoever. Certainly, if I on your third point, for these Southern lawyers to defend Plessy v. Ferguson, which was so hollow. That's the height of judicial activism, where the Supreme Court essentially makes up a law out of thin air in 1896, 1898. These are lawyers, they know better, certainly. And I think I state explicitly in my book, even if you look at a lot of them said you had to follow stare decisis and precedent. By 1954, Plessy v. Ferguson was on very, very wobbly a foundation, and the precedent had been set going 30 years back of really challenging the unconstitutionality of defining people by according to the color of their skin. Certainly, for a lot of these Southern lawyers, really intelligent Southern lawyers, North Carolina Sam. I forget the name. Later becomes prominent in the Watergate hearings, certainly Richard Russell and John Stennis. These are John Stennis is a former judge, and I think you can look at them you can look at their writings. They certainly knew better.
Well, and it's interesting too because you bring up. Let's talk about how then this became. Kind of the moderate consensus on Brown and how the kind of leads the way to go slow and kind of this moderation.
By the summer of 1956, by the spring of 1956, the data shows that approximately 10% of the public schools in the states of the former Confederacy and the border states were desegregated. Now, these were largely schools with relatively small populations of African-American students, places like my own Fayetteville High School. There was actually some wind in the sails. There was some real progress to be made by that. Another thing I think we should remember, I think we dismiss the really tough requirements of the 1957 Civil Rights Act. We have to remember that the 1957 Civil Rights Act was the first civil rights bill since Reconstruction. It essentially creates a civil rights division in the Attorney General's office. Bobby Kennedy uses it explicitly to desegregate the South and to litigate the South in the early 1960s. It's a very powerful piece of legislation. And I think astute political observers like Richard Russell and them, they knew that. They understood that. So it's one of the reasons they were able to block it. Senate Majority Leader Lyndon Johnson, of course, who very much had presidential aspirations, both in 56 and, of course, 1960. He really wanted a go slow approach on desegregation. Of course, he represents Texas, which we think is a former Confederate state. But as you can see through the Texas congressional delegations, signing of the Southern Manifesto, that's largely confined to East Texas. Most of the West Texas congressmen do not sign. They're not committed to segregation like, you know, the Cotton Belt of East Texas. So he's kind of represents that straddling that ground. Taking the 1957 Civil Rights Act off the legislative docket in 1956 does set a precedent. And you also see this. Democratic Governor Alan Shivers of Texas, he uses Texas Rangers to block desegregation in Mansfield, Texas. And President Eisenhower does nothing on that because he doesn't want to upset the apple cart in the 1956 election. As I argue in the book, Orville Faubus kind of took that as a precedent, tried to do that with Central High. Once Eisenhower is freed up in his second term, that doesn't float anymore. And so that essentially, of course, the subsequent Supreme Court case, Cooper v. Era, and essentially takes interposition off the books. But of course, that delay, that certainly does set a precedent for going slow. And I say ultimately denying a whole generation of African Americans the first rate public education. Not until the Supreme Court steps in the late 1960s do they force, you know, with all deliberate speed to mean what it says.
Yeah, and I think that, thank you for the moderation clarification. I think that the other kind of prong of this is that you do kind of lead us into massive resistance and how, you know, doctrine of interposition plays into that, and Byrd, coining this term massive resistance. So maybe we can end on kind of what massive resistance is and what interpositionism.
Well, I think you probably told my book, I'm not a big fan of interposition. They tried to resurrect some antebellum legal theories, you know, that John Calhoun used in his South Carolina exposition protest in 1831, which of course is settled by the Civil War and of course settled by Andrew Jackson's declaration. And for them to go around saying that the states had a right to do this was ridiculous. As you could probably tell, I'm not a fan of local and state governments saying that we will not comply with federal law. This is, which of course, if you said today, we've got a big problem with this going on in today's political environment. This doctrine of interposition is absurd in the 1950s and even more absurd today. They were able to use it. Of course, it's negated by the Supreme Court in 57 with Cooper v. Aaron. Excuse me, 58, I think it was. But of course, Governor Rossbarr, not in Mississippi, tries to use it in 61, bowls over that new President John Kennedy. You see this in other areas as well. But it's the doctrine of interposition was put forth by John James Kilpatrick, from Richmond, Virginia, longtime political reporter and journalist. Of course, I hate to say he's a fellow University of Missouri alumnus. And I hope he didn't learn it in Missouri, but it was a fantastical idea then, and of course, even more absurd now.
Well, thank you for bringing Southern Manifesto back to us and kind of putting it into the missing piece, I think, in the puzzle of why civil rights took so long to get out of the 50s, you know, when we seem to have some momentum going. And I think your book does that very well.
Thank you, and I hope you enjoy it. And I hope people will revisit this very crucial area of scholarship. I think we need to remember the legacy of the Brown decision. I consider Brown v. Board of Education the most important, the greatest Supreme Court decision in American history. And if going back to your initial question about today, I think we need to remember Brown and study. That very important decision in American history. It's crucial to our understanding of modern America today.
Thanks for listening to Unpacking 1619. For more information on Heights Library 1619 Project Discussion Group, or to check out more interviews with scholars, please visit heightslibrary.org. See you next episode, wherever you listen to podcasts.